Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm a fellow here in the Energy and National Security Program at CSIS. And on behalf of the CSIS Energy Program and our colleagues and co-hosts of today's event, the World Resources Institute, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's event about natural gas. For those of you who don't know, and I see a lot of familiar faces out there, so we've had a cooperation a year and a half long or so with the World Resources Institute that's been designed at looking towards issues of balancing energy security concerns and climate change. So several months ago, I believe it was January of this year, our work together sort of culminated in the publication of a roadmap for the next administration, a plan, as think tanks like to do when there's a new administration in town, for how to balance energy security and climate change issues and concerns going forward. And the crux of sort of the framework, and I won't go through all of the recommendations that we put in place, was this idea that a lot of what we're talking about when we talk about meeting our climate change and energy security goals all have to do with transitions that take place over a long period of time, decades, not necessarily years. So we established sort of a framework for thinking about these issues. The first aspect of that framework was to have sort of a coherent vision of where you're going. Whenever you have a lot of investment that needs to take place or major systems to sort of coordinate, you need to kind of know where you're trying to go and what your goals are long term. And the second part was sort of resetting the system of incentives to prioritize things that are lower carbon, things that are energy secure fuels, and to sort of incorporate those priorities into the way that our energy system works. And the third and final section of the roadmap was this idea of managing the transition, this idea that over the near and medium term, there are going to be things that we need to do to make sure that we enable ourselves to get to our ultimate vision. So it's not like flipping a light switch. You can't just, or pressing an easy button. You can't just be where you'd like to be automatically. There are things that you're going to have to do and ways that you're going to have to work together on sort of energy policy and commercial investments over the medium term. And a lot of those things in managing the transition had to do with promoting efficiency as sort of the easiest, though it's not easy, near-term and sort of unconflicted way of improving energy security and climate change. The second portion is, you know, recognizing that the energy system we have relies on things that are necessarily some good for energy security, some good for climate change, and you have to sort of reconcile the things that are good for climate change need to become better for energy security, and the things that are good for energy security need to become better in terms of our climate change goals. And the final two recommendations we had in that section sort of dealt with these issues, role of oil in the transportation sector and the role of natural gas in terms of a bridging fuel. And we had identified a while back the issue of natural gas, which we're here to discuss today, as one of those really complicated but not necessarily discussed enough topics when it comes to the transition to a low-carbon energy future. And we're really glad to say that in the last several months, because of emerging climate and energy legislation and new reports about ample sort of domestic gas reserves or resources, that natural gas has sort of come to the forefront in many of the same ways that we thought it would be an interesting discussion when we first set out under this cooperation. So I know many of you haven't had a chance to read the working paper that we worked on to sort of explore some of the climate and energy implications of natural gas use and the role of natural gas as a bridge to this low-carbon energy future. But there are copies outside. There will be copies on our website, and we'd love to hear from you with feedback about that. I just want to really quick give credit to the people who've been working on this issue with us. Matt Frank, who is Matt, can you stand up real quick? Matt Frank, who's becoming sort of the in-house unconventional gas guru for us here at CSIS. Two other authors, Kate Zyla, formerly of the World Resources Institute, and Jenna Goodwood, also formerly of the World Resources Institute. And then always Britt Staley, who is our very able partner over at the World Resources Institute as well. We've all been sort of meeting with people, discussing some of these issues, and trying to find ways to bring some of the framing issues to the fore. So today is sort of a continuation of the exploration that we've been doing for over the last year or so. So we're really happy that you all can be here today, and we've got two really great panels. The first, which I'll be moderating, is sort of an exploration of the issues. We've got Michael Schall from the Energy Information Administration to talk about sort of an outlook for natural gas resources and demand in the United States. Sharon Buccino from Natural Resources Defense Council to talk about the climate and environmental implications. And then our very own Frank Verastro from CSIS to talk about some of the energy security implications. The second panel, which Debbie Bodger from the World Resources Institute will moderate, is going to sort of deal more with sort of the affected communities dealing with some of the implications that we'll talk about on the first panel. So we'll have presentations first and then followed up by Q&A, but thank you all for being here today. And Michael, you can kick it off.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me here today. Can you all hear me there and back? Is this picking up? I'm not getting it. Good. Excellent. Before I begin, I think many of you know who EIA is, but for those who don't, I'll just quickly say that EIA is an independent statistical and analytic agency within the Department of Energy. We are an independent agency, which means that what I say here today does not reflect the views of the Department of Energy or the administration. For the past 15 years, as I've been analyzing natural gas markets, I've been struck by how often natural gas is thought of as the Bondo of the energy markets. And for those who aren't aware of car repairs, oftentimes if you have a car that's been hit and they can't pull the dent out, the person fixing the car will use this patch compound called Bondo to fill in the crack and the valleys, the dents in the car, and then paint it, and then you look like you have a brand new car. And natural gas certainly does, from an analytic perspective, look like a great way to fill in the gaps of energy supply going forward. The case seems obvious. Natural gas has a low carbon content as compared to other fuels, and in the power sector in particular, natural gas can be used more efficiently than some of the other fuels, such as coal, at a lower capital cost. Well, I'm going to start off by spending a few minutes on the changing outlook for natural gas that EIA has had over the last couple of years in terms of consumption and production. And I'm going to also spend a little bit of time and put a little bit of emphasis on the changing outlook on the supply side, which is encouraging many people to reevaluate the prospects for using natural gas and relying upon natural gas. I'll also finish with a few observations from EIA's own analysis of greenhouse gas modeling, with a focus on the natural gas consumption aspects. So this will be interesting, left-handed. So when we look at the history of consumption of natural gas within the United States from 1960 to present, we see that natural gas consumption peaked in the early 70s at above 20 TCF, experienced a decline through the 1980s, and then an increase from the 1980s through the 1990s as natural gas became accepted more in industrial applications and also power sector applications. However, starting with about the mid-1990s, corresponded with an ongoing decline in industrial sector natural gas use, even as the electric power sector was increasing a little bit its natural gas consumption. As a result, over the last decade or so, natural gas consumption has been at about the 20 to 23 TCF level. Production, on the other hand, since about the 1980s, has not kept up with the increase in consumption or the rebound in consumption. Indeed, over that time frame, net imports, which in the past have principally come from Canada natural gas supplies, have helped make up the difference. Now, a few years ago, and here I have the consumption pattern from our Annual Energy Outlook 2007, which was actually released in December of of 2006. And here we saw that natural gas consumption would be increasing slightly, reflecting, among other things, this large construction or building boom of new gas-fired combined cycle power plants, which rely principally on natural gas as fuel. On the other hand, we saw the U.S. or domestic production of natural gas being basically stable. And by basically stable, what the industry itself was looking at the time was, how are we going to maintain production levels at these prices, given that every time we drill a well, it immediately goes into decline. So we have to, the industry itself was finding it in a position where it was having to drill increasing numbers of wells in order to just maintain production, let alone increase production. And that really was the outlook or the industry view of just a few years ago. As a result, in our projections, EIA was showing that net imports of natural gas were set to rise from about 16% of consumption to as much as 21% of consumption in our reference case. Now we fast forward to just this year, and what we're finding is two things. First of all, the use of natural gas in the power sector is actually projected to decline, and there's a couple reasons for this. One of these reasons is that energy efficiency in the electric power sector has been greater than what had previously been anticipated. Energy conservation measures, people's willingness to use higher efficiency appliances, even changes in lighting, such as compact fluorescent light bulbs, have all impacted electric sector demand. And this has had a more dramatic effect on natural gas than other fuels, since natural gas is pretty much the marginal fuel in most areas of the country. Another reason for this decreased outlook in natural gas consumption is that many states have passed renewable portfolio standards, which have dictated a certain amount of renewable generation be brought online. So in the context of having both a decreased electric demand outlook and an increased amount of supply from other sources, natural gas has become somewhat squeezed in the middle. Now, in the longer term, you can see that in this projection, we're showing an increase in natural gas production consumption, and this is motivated in part due to eventually needing more generation from natural gas and the difficulties that have emerged for financing new coal-fired projects. And as a result, after a certain amount of time, natural gas does pick up some of the marginal growth in load in consumption. On the production side, we have an environment where we have higher prices motivating more drilling. We have improvements in technology, which I'll go into a little bit more in depth a little later on. We have a larger resource base, and therefore we have actually a narrowing in the gap between domestic production of natural gas and consumption. Now, a few years ago, when we were looking at the future of net imports, what was filling in the gap was LNG. And at that time, a few years ago, EIA was forecasting or projecting that about 4.6 TCF of supply in 2030 would come from LNG as pipeline imports from Canada would be decreasing. And in context, other organizations were forecasting that LNG would constitute anywhere from 8 to 11 TCF of LNG at that time. So EIA was at the lower end of that range. As of now, because of this narrowing of the gap in terms of LNG, EIA is forecasting less than 1 TCF comes from LNG. Other forecasters have some have lowered their forecasts to 3 TCF. Others are very bullish on LNG, supplying large quantities of LNG to the U.S., and they're up at 11 TCF. And this points to one of the uncertainties that we have in looking at projections of supply, and that is just how much of the world's liquefaction of natural gas will make it to the U.S., how much will be marketed to the U.S. below the price that would be required by domestic producers. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to move right on to the supply aspects. And in this chart, what I'm showing is from the progression of EIA's own resource estimates from AEO 2006 through AEO 2009. And as you can see, over time, in particular in the most recent projection, the resource estimate has been raised rather substantially. EIA for the past, 20 years or so has been modeling unconventional natural gas, and in particular the coal bed methanes, the tight gas formations, as well as gas shales. However, this past year, with the advent of the Marcellus and the Haynesville plays and the estimated amounts of gas from those areas, there is significantly more gas available to be brought into production. And I don't know, since I don't have a laser pointer, I'll see if I can use this. Most of the development of the gas shale technology that allowed for this resource to be brought into play has centered around the Barnett. Now, as we've moved over to Haynesville and up into Marcellus, you can see that the gas shales have really sort of blossomed. And actually, this chart represents only those gas shales for which there are resource estimates known. There are many other gas shales that could be produced from. And indeed, this technology is such it could be applied internationally. Among other areas, up in Canada, the Bighorn region could be one area that gas can be produced from this resource base. I'll also note that this chart is available from EIA's website for those who are interested in looking at this chart in a little bit more detail. We also have maps of the coal bed methane and some of the tight gas or some of the other formations. So just to underline the extent to which unconventional resources have impacted our estimates of the natural gas resource base, with proved reserves at 211 TCF, and then we have the other categories such as inferred reserves and undiscovered reserves, you can see that the unconventionals, which consist of, from left to right, the tight gas, the coal bed methane, and the shale gas, are the largest component of this resource base. And that has an implication in terms of cost. Yes, it's a larger resource than the other forms of the resource base, but we require the application of certain technologies such as horizontal drilling, such as hydraulic fracturing, and each of these shale plays have certain characteristics that need to have some research performed in order to achieve economic quantities of production to occur. As such, there are certain higher costs involved. Now, the Potential Gas Committee has released recently its most up-to-date estimate of the natural gas resource base, and they're, as you can see on the far right, up at about 2,000 TCF of resource base, a fairly hefty increase of about 36% over its last estimate made in 2006. Which in itself was an increase over the 2004 estimate. Now, one of the things that I've done with this chart is on the far left, if you took the 1986 estimate of the resource base and applied, assumed that that was the level of the resource base that was available and subtracted out the production that occurred in each of those years, which you'd be end up with, as represented to the right, a lower resource left if you had just held yourself constant at 1986 levels. And what this highlights is that even though we've had an increase in the estimate of the resource base, this has exceeded the cumulative production that has occurred over time. Indeed, it's basically doubled the amount we thought we had in the mid-1980s. Now, in this chart, as I alluded to earlier, this increase in the resource base has not necessarily led to a decrease in price, and that is because of the higher costs associated with extracting this resource. There are two parts to this puzzle, one of which I've discussed, which is this requires more operations out in the field and more maintenance and keeping the flow going. But also, commodity costs as a whole over this time have increased. Steel, labor have increased, and this has impacted the costs in the field as well, resulting in a higher natural gas price. And if I have a few minutes left.
Couple.
Okay, good. I'll discuss briefly EIA's most recent greenhouse gas analysis, and this was released last year. It's the Lieberman-Warner analysis of Senate Bill 2191. And just concentrating on the natural gas demand on the far right, what you see is that the orange bar to the left represents the AEO, the Annual Energy Outlook, reference case result. The next bar, where there's a decrease in natural gas consumption, as represented by the blue bar, represents natural gas consumption assuming that certain technologies such as our carbon capture and sequestration, advanced nuclear, and other non-fossil or reduced or low emission or reduced emission technologies are made available. So in that instance, natural gas consumption actually decreases through the application or the change to these other technologies and also the decrease in total electricity demand in particular. Now, the other two bands, as represented here in, I guess that's either yellow or light green, and the green, represent a case where suppose those technologies are not available. Suppose the nuclear can't be built. Suppose we're not able to bring in LNG at attractive prices, pricing, and these alternatives to natural gas are not available. In that case, natural gas consumption increases to as much as 27 TCF. But again, two things to keep in mind. Even though natural gas itself is a low-carbon fuel, it does have some carbon, and therefore end users do see an increase in price beyond just the increase in the commodity cost of trying to increase this amount of supply. And that has an impact on their consumption. And that's all I have to say about that. So in conclusion, it's quite clear the natural gas resource base has expanded rather dramatically over the past 2 years. However, I hope I've brought to your attention that this has been an ongoing process. The production costs have increased due to the shift to the unconventional natural gas supply and the increase in the commodity costs. This has had some offset effect by the improvements in the technology, which have reduced prices somewhat through increased productivity, but not yet, not to an extent that would completely offset the increase in cost. Natural gas consumption has reflected downward trends in both the industrial and not as aggressive into the electric power sector as of yet. I also have on this slide the transportation sector, and really it's the transportation sector where we have a short analysis that we have in our most recent annual energy outlook, which point out some of the infrastructure issues with not allowing for or would be a barrier to widespread acceptance of natural gas in transportation. And finally, again, I'd like to highlight that there are options to natural gas that currently do exist, and they may exist in the future sooner or later than we expect. And the increased cost in the power sector is in itself an incentive to reduce consumption and therefore avoid these increase in costs. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Michael. And if I forgot to mention before, we'll go through all of the speakers on the panel and then take questions after. And our next speaker is Sharon Buccino from the Land and Wildlife Program, Director of the Land and Wildlife Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Thank you. It's good to be here. And I think I'll really start where Michael left off and build on some of what he said. Because I think there are two facts that are clearly in agreement. I mean, we do have a lot of natural gas. That's one. The second is that it is cleaner burning than some of the fuels we're using for electricity now, coal. But it does have carbon emissions. And it does have impacts in terms of getting the gas out of the ground. And that's the area that I work in, particularly working on issues related to the management of the public lands in the West and working with communities in the West around natural gas issues. I think we saw the last explosion of supply was really in the coal bed methane realm, which was pretty much an issue in the Rockies, Wyoming, in particular, Colorado, a little bit in Montana. Now what we're seeing with the development of the shales and taking gas from shale, that it is no longer just a Western issue by any means. Some of the biggest resources are, in fact, in the east, the Marcellus Shale really running all the way up through Pennsylvania into New York. And so what we've seen is that the issues around natural gas extraction have really become a very important, in some places controversial issues. I guess what I'd like to address today is to identify some of those issues, some of the potential consequences, impacts of getting the gas out of the ground, and offering a few suggestions as to how to address them so that we can, in fact, tap into the natural gas that the country has to help meet our energy needs. I would like to start with the slide, very helpful slide that you had in terms of the projection of the role of natural gas in the nation's future under a carbon constrained or under some kind of climate legislation. As you can see, there is a role for natural gas, but it's not an increasing role, and that's NRDC's position. We do acknowledge a role for natural gas, but we need the amount of carbon emissions that we need, you know, 80% or more reduction in emissions of carbon dioxide, really in the long term force us to look to other solutions such as renewables, and that's why you've seen the push around renewable energy standards and the push to efficiency, getting the gains from efficiency and looking to renewables in terms of, well, where are we going to invest as a nation going forward. But let me turn to specifically how we get the gas out of the ground and to identify some of the impacts from doing so. So just a few statistics on what has happened with oil and gas production. It has, in fact, seen a pretty dramatic increase. Again, it's not only in the West. Just a couple of figures to compare the late 1980s to what we saw last year. As you saw in the graphs of the production graph, the dramatic increase has tapered off a little bit in response to the economy. There are not the number of drills operating that there were a couple of years ago by any means, but we are increasing our production of natural gas. And just the kind of the categories of environmental impacts, I originally, and I think NRDC originally came to the issues really from the land impacts, the impact on the ground to areas, some of the wilderness areas in the West, areas that people look to recreate and value for their land values, the natural and cultural resource values, the wildlife values, and we have seen significant impacts there in terms if you're looking to lease for oil and gas lands, some of our last lands, lands with wilderness qualities, and you are going to lose those lands as wilderness resources. There's tremendous, I think one of the other potential, one of the other impacts that has to be dealt with is the fragmentation of the landscape, which has significant impacts on wildlife, whether it's the pronghorn or game that are a very valuable resource to states for hunting, such as mule deer or elk. But then a couple of other categories go more toward the public health impacts, and as we've seen the move into the shales in areas that are, in fact, really residential areas, areas that people are living in, and you have drilling happening in people's backyards and their communities, then we have potential issues related not only to noise but also the water and air pollution that can occur. Specifically on air, there are hazardous air pollutants that are an issue. A growing problem has related to ozone, which comes from the volatile organic compounds and the NOx that are emitted from the drilling rigs, but also the truck traffic that's needed to develop the sites and then maintain them. And the last category is the particulate matter. I found this a helpful map just to show. This is actually from an area in Colorado out on the western slope of the Rockies near Grand Junction in Garfield County, just so you can see where the activity is occurring and how it is, in fact, beginning to occur more and more in areas that people are living in. So the green on this map, the dark green, are residential land parcels. Groundwater contamination is another issue, and this has become particularly controversial because of the technologies that are needed to extract the gas from shale. To free up the gas from the shale, the rock, the formation needs to be fractured. And that involves, there are different mixes that are used. We have been working with a number of companies that use green fracking fluid, so do not have the toxic chemical components in it. But one of the big issues for communities is that there is a proprietary nature to the constituents of the fracking component, because the exact mix is something that the companies put a lot of effort, have invested a lot of resources into developing what fracking mixture works the best, and so they're not interested in disclosing that information. From the community side of things, there is a lot of concern about the potential for those fluids to get into drinking water supplies, and without the information, there has been a lot of fear that has occurred around this issue. And so that's a dilemma that we're really still trying to work through, how you balance the legitimate proprietary interest in the information on the industry's part against the legitimate right-to-know issues related to the citizens that are in the community where the drilling is occurring. This is just a photo from one site in terms of those are the drilling pits that are used. And there are, clearly some companies do a better job than others. There are ways to allow to manage the waste and to reclaim the land. We're still, the communities I've worked with in, say, in Wyoming, for example, are still very much in the middle of the boom of drilling. And so we really have not seen started to see meaningful reclamation on a very large scale. I think if we could get to that point, or we had companies affirmatively investing quite a bit on the reclamation side as well as the production side, I think that would go a long way in terms of diffusing some of the controversy and helping get more of the gas out of the ground. And just a few of the wildlife impacts. I touched on the issue of fragmentation. There's also issues related to actual destruction of the habitat. That's just a visual image of to give you a sense of the fragmentation. Now, this is coal bed methane development, which does require a lot of wells. I think increasingly with the shale, there is use of directional drilling, where you have a single well pad that is drilling a number of different wells to access the resource, which clearly does minimize the fragmentation on the ground and therefore the impacts to wildlife. And then I wanted to make sure to also address the solution side of things, because there are ways to get the resource out of the ground while minimizing the impacts, and I think that's the solution we and NRDC see in terms of allowing us to achieve, meet our energy needs while avoiding unnecessary impacts and ensuring that we are sustaining the landscape that we want, which people, some of these wild places in the West, people really see as part of the American identity, and also sustaining the kind of communities in which we all want to live. We touched on the idea of efficiency was mentioned earlier in terms of this really is what, our position related to natural gas is to make sure we've done as much as we can on efficiency, recognizing that it's not going to get us everywhere, but this is clearly where we have the best opportunities to achieve not only climate solutions but also keep the cost of the resource down by making sure we're using the resource as efficiently as possible. And this is just a graph demonstrating the potential that does exist in terms of really added resource. I mean, we're getting natural gas savings through efficiency, and that is one reason why we as an organization, NRDC, have put a lot of effort behind the efficiency side of things as opposed to really promoting natural gas as a solution to climate change. I would like to end with, this is actually a quote from Williams Exploration and Production Company, which is probably the same kind of quote I would give, which is that we don't have to choose between a clean and healthy environment and a healthy and growing economy. We need the gas. We have it. But there are ways that we can get it out of the ground while minimizing the impacts. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Sharon. Next up, we've got Frank Marastro, who's a senior fellow and the director of the energy program here at CSIS. So I know many of you know him. And we don't usually make it a practice of putting our own scholars, if you will, on our own panels. But frankly, from my perspective, I can't think of a better person to talk about the energy security implications of gas. So, Frank.
Thank you. I actually wanted to moderate the panel so I could introduce myself. But that would have gone well. Sarah talked about the report we had done. So what we were looking to do was build a roadmap for a low-carbon economy and recognizing that efficiency has a clear role to play, that renewables have a clear role to play. There are technologies that need to be developed over the next 30 years or so, but managing that transition is a key. And as you move renewables and research, you also better keep your conventional system robust and healthy, because in the event the technology is not there or the scalable alternative is not there as demand grows, you need a plan B. And in some cases, that's a plan A. So hearing some of the comments this morning, and this is not atypical for my colleagues that see me work here before, I'm going to start where I plan to end. So the policy model that we've developed, and there's a lot of people in this room that worked with us on the National Petroleum Council study, this is what we use to evaluate the policy in the NPC study. And there's a couple of valuable takeaways here. And one is that you need to balance, going forward, advocacy aside, economics, foreign policy, national security, and environmental risks. And you need to consider all three. And when you look at what fuels, specific fuels, are highlighted and fit in the individual categories, you find that efficiencies and renewables kind of fit near the center of the circle. Almost everything else is a trade-off. And that's really what governance is all about. So it's trading off your policies, looking at land use, looking at water quality, looking at economics and development, looking at your national security impacts, and then you can actually kind of decide what's scalable alternatives, what's happening in a certain time frame, and how you bring things forward. But this balance is really important. What you don't want to do as a policymaker is get caught on one corner of the triangle and look through that prism only. Because if you're China and you're looking at security more than anything else, it's coal. Well, coal's not the answer on the environmental side. If you're in Europe and you're looking at security issues, there's roles for natural gas. There's other alternatives, efficiency, clearly, and renewables and new technology. But just kind of keep the balance idea in mind. All right, so why is gas so special? And I think you'll hear this a little bit from David later on. But it's readily available in significant quantities. Michael has already told you that. It's reliable historically. It's transportable. It's storable. It's flexible. We use it in power generation for base, for peak, and increasingly as we go to alternative energy forms, renewables, it will be the balancer because it's an easy thing to do. It's domestic if you look at what Michael had said in terms of the resource-based potential. It's environmentally more beneficial than some other alternatives, although it's not no carbon, it's low carbon. And it has multiple uses. It's used as a feedstock, it's used in process heat, it's used for heating and cooling. It can be used for transportation. We think that power generation is clearly advantageous over transportation for a variety of infrastructure and hurdle reasons, but there are a variety of uses for natural gas. So we think it's a clear-cut winner. Michael talked about this a little. If you go out to 2030 or 2035, gas use, depending on your assumptions, where you are on CCS with respect to coal, how much efficiency you can achieve, where you are in terms of deploying renewables, gas use is expected to increase. And, in fact, in the power generation sector, it's a clear-cut winner, at least in the near term. So the good news is we've got it. The gas supply sources, if you look at it from a security aspect for the United States, there's conventional onshore, there's unconventional onshore, there's offshore, there's imports, there's pipeline gas from Canada and LNG from a variety of sources. And then we have the Alaskan and the Arctic resources, which are a little bit further out. All have their benefits, all have their advocates, all have their challenges. This is an EIA slide, so Michael, I'm glad you're here. But as conventional supplies decline, the gap looks to be filled by LNG and unconventional gas in the United States onshore. And when you look at the resource base, this makes sense. The question is, given the price, what comes in sooner? And will LNG, because liquefaction investments have been made, displace some of the investments in unconventional gas, or do we use domestic resources? And this has applications globally. It's not just in the United States, and I'll get to that in a second. Again, EIA, so growth in dry natural gas production is led by the unconventionals. So it's coal seam, tight sands, and increasingly now the shale gas. So it's good that the resource base has increased. And we talked about the estimates and how they've changed over time. So high prices, technology, and access have really turned what we had as a deficit in U.S. gas into a surplus the last couple of years. But we can talk about the challenges there and well, and they're located throughout the United States. The variety of estimates for gas shale resources has continued to grow as we have more experience with the formations and the technology improves, and we deploy that technology by seasoned veterans who know what they're doing. The Potential Gas Committee talked about 616 TCF of undiscovered unconventional and 2,000 TCF in terms of resources. So at 20 TCF a year, that's a 100-year supply if it's fully exploited and realized. The difference here, and that this is a chart that we used actually when USGS came here earlier in the year. So typical formations for oil and gas, conventional formations, are in traps or stratigraphic traps or formations. The shale gas is source rock. That's why it's so easy to access if you have the technology. So the combination of fracking fluids, horizontal drilling technology, flooding in some cases, and the access to those areas in a higher price environment has allowed you to access that, and that's what brought this new resource to fruition, and that's where the real potential is. So it's different, and these shales are found throughout the world. Michael talked about this as well. So as domestic gas production, if it were allowed to increase, we could reduce import reliance, and we're actually forecasting a reduction in imports of pipeline gas from Canada. And this is the challenge, but realizing the full promise of gas is not a certainty. And we went through this on the oil side. You know, 5 years ago, we talked about peak oil, and our position had always been that the resource endowment, when you measure it as molecules in the ground, is enormous. It's trillions of barrels. So we thought it wasn't the geology in that case, but it's the above-ground issues. It's geography, it's geopolitics, it's security, it's the environment, it's infrastructure, it's transportation. These are the limiting factors. And it's similar for natural gas. So there's technical, what we call technical and economic challenges. All shales are not alike. They have different porosity and permeability. The application of drilling and reservoir techniques matters, and experience, the operators, also matter. We're finding a large discrepancy in what's economic depending on what your lease cost was. If you got into a shale tract 5 years ago, and you were looking at, you know, $100 an acre, your economics are far better than if you bought in late. Drilling costs, drilling equipment, steel, people, those costs in 2008 skyrocketed. Well, they're all coming down. We met with some of the service companies yesterday, and they're renegotiating their contracts. So we expect to see the cost curve come down, which could make some of these producers are making money at $3.50. Some require over $6. Steep decline rates, and I'll show you a chart on this. We had an unconventional gas session here about a month and a half ago. And in the first 14 months, the decline rates can be 60%. If that's the case, you continuously have to keep drilling, and you need the investment to do that. The upfront investment on lease acreage, this is not it's not insurmountable, but it's significant, especially for the independents. And the independents do most of the unconventional gas drilling in this country. And when you consider the tax implications, G&G costs, geophysical and geologic costs, and the expensing are more important to the independents, less important to the majors. The majors, the manufacturing tax changes or inventory tax changes are more instrumental in making business decisions. And then you look at environmental, regulatory, and what I'll call societal challenges. And Sharon talked a little bit about this, but uncertain regulation in fracking. some of these shales, and I'll show you a map in just a second, but the Marcellus runs from southwest New York down to Kentucky. So these are areas that have not seen typically large-scale oil and gas drilling. And to some people, this looks like industrialization. It's roads, it's dirt, it's noise, it's wells. It's not what people are used to. The development plans and the associated impacts are the above-ground issues that I think may be one of the things that stop realization of the below-ground potential. And this is something we need to consider if we want this to be part of the mix. And location, location, location. So you'll find that the shales in different places, and it's better graphically illustrated here. On the western side, you'll find that there's not a lot of pipeline infrastructure, but there are interconnects that you can do to minimize cost. And the eastern side, Bobby Hefner is an independent gas producer and typically uses this slide to say, if you look at the Marcellus, which is the big blob on the East Coast, then it's near major consumption centers and there's a lot of infrastructure. And that's the good news. The bad news is it's near major consumption centers and there's a lot of infrastructure. You're not going to drill 1,000 wells around Philadelphia. It's a different situation. This is the independence prospect. So when you look at the size, who actually drills for unconventional gas in the United States? Do we need separate policies when we look at the independence? When we look at the core people that are delivering this resource, does it make a difference how we treat them in terms of policy, whether it's tax policy, regulatory policy, access, leases? And if we turn this over to the majors, does the profile change? Because a lot of the majors have international investments in liquefaction facilities overseas. This is the decline rate. This is, I think, from the Haynesville, but it just shows you that you continually have to keep drilling and make that investment. And you frack more than once. So you fracture the well, and 4 years later you may bring the rate up because you fracture again. But this is an ongoing process, and these are not inexpensive. The global gas dilemma. So gas demand is going to grow globally, especially in a carbon-constrained world, until we have alternatives. Scalable renewables, maybe nuclear. The IEA, which will be here, this is a blatant plug for us next week. We've got the IEA short-term oil and gas outlook here on the 30th, and you're all invited to come to that session. But they show that coal consumption can decline from 40% globally to 20% globally. But the gap is filled by efficiency and renewables to a lesser extent, but a lot of nuclear and a lot of natural gas. That's the only way that you get there. Conventional supply sources become more concentrated. For the U.S. in terms of imports, once you get by Canada, Trinidad, Tobago, and Australia, for those people that were concerned about where we got our oil from, their hydrocarbon resources, they come from the same parts of the world. It's Russia, the Caspian, Africa, and the Middle East. Delivery systems are under greater stress, and I'll show you that in a second. But when you talk about choke points for oil and you look at Chinese demand, Malacca becomes a much bigger deal for the Chinese on the gas side than it ever was on the oil side. And price rise plus increased import dependence puts you in the same basket that we were talking about last year at this time on balance of payments issues. This is a chart of unconventional gas supplies throughout the world. So it's fairly spread out. There's a lot of potential. If you actually get into methane hydrates, the map totally shifts. Japan becomes a net exporter. But if you look at proved natural gas reserves, the bulk of it's in the Middle East and Eurasia. And that's not surprising because this is where the major hydrocarbon resources are. And you look at the trade flows and choke points out to 2030, if you assume a greater dependence on natural gas, this means greater concentration of supply and more shipping. Now, what could happen if the unconventional gas shales are tapped worldwide? It can change a lot of these dynamics. And the European slide, excellent timing on this. So in Europe, when we talk about Russian supplies, U.S. policy for the last several years has focused a lot on Nabucco pipeline, moving natural gas 3,000 kilometers from the east to the west. If you have indigenous shales coupled with alternative energy and also look at efficiency changes and LNG and interconnections, you can actually change the map of Europe. It takes infrastructure investment, but it's not all going one way. This is all about diversity, which kind of brings me back to the policy model. So I guess the only thing I would try to leave you with is, as we consider this, great new resource. We ought to be excited. Has this challenge. We need a regulatory policy and an energy policy, frankly, that tries to balance these three things, pulls out the best in all of them, and lays out a plan for managing this transition. We all know we're going to a lower carbon future, but the path to getting there, we can either really screw it up royally or we can do it correctly. Thanks, sir.
Okay, great. I think we've got about 20 minutes or so, 20, 25 minutes for questions. So while you're thinking of your questions, I'm going to start it off for the panel. Michael, question sort of directed to you, but anyone can feel free to answer if they want. So given the fact that EIA is a very well-respected institution in terms of its unbiased analysis, and I'm not just saying that because Guy Caruso, former head of EIA, now works here, there a number of things that both Sharon and Frank brought up. One, Frank's point about some of the sort of material and production costs coming down from the highs that we saw over the last couple years. And then on Sharon's point, some of the above ground issues that are always sort of plaguing any sort of infrastructure, energy infrastructure development here in the U.S. How do those factors sort of influence how you look at the production of this potential sort of going forward?
Certainly. Well, actually, I'm glad I have a chance to address that particular issue, and that is whenever we see that there's an run-up in gas, natural gas prices, there tends to be historically an approach the industry takes towards getting really excited about the prospects and start bidding up labor, rigs, and other necessary parts necessary to drill wells. And as a result, what you see is escalation in the fields that goes above and beyond inflation that occurs elsewhere in the world or the nation. We've built into our models this phenomenon of escalation that occurs beyond inflation. So even though there has been escalation, and now that there's less activity, that escalation has dropped quite a bit, and yes, there is some renegotiation of contracts, we still have this inflation that has been built into the system that exists. And of course, there are certainly wells that can be drilled at below $6 and $7, but those marginal wells up in the $7, $8, and $9 level may be necessary to be drilled in order to be brought into production. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the issue of the geographic extent over which drilling is occurring, that is a very important point. One of the issues that strikes us as we analyze this particular issue is as we've moved into more of the eastern U.S., or actually back into the eastern U.S., I should say, and we have communities impacted with this drilling, one of the differences is the use of water. Now, in the west, we actually have a system in place of clearly defined water rights. And so there is a way in which the ownership of water, the use of the water, can be transacted and included in the cost of doing business. In the East, it's a slightly different situation, as I'm given to understand, and that is it's first come, first serve, essentially. I'm not quite sure what the legal definition is, but it basically means that someone could back up to a stream and pull all the water out and use it for their purposes of sticking it in the ground. And that tends to have certain cause certain problems with those people who are living in those areas and seeing this type of activity going on. There's really not that legal structure in place that existed in the West, and that is one of the issues that's coming to the fore there. That and the issues of the hydraulic fracturing and the potential, if not the actual environmental issues associated with that, have resulted in a backlash mm-hmm. that you see on within Congress and in pushing various legislation.
Great, thanks. Okay, we'll open it up for your questions now. We do have a couple of ground rules. Wait for a microphone. Please identify yourself and your affiliation. And as always, if your question can be in the form of a question, we really appreciate it. Reed?
Reed Detchen with the Energy Future Coalition. I wonder if the panel would comment on the effect on the natural gas market if the U.S. moves rapidly to electrify its light-duty vehicle fleet.
I guess the question is, what's rapidly? We have 240 million cars, right? So even if you were to do 10 million a year, you're looking at decades. What makes this so complex, and I'm not avoiding the question, but what makes it so complex is if you assume CCS is a viable alternative at scale, then you preserve the role of coal. If CCS doesn't come on until post-2020, you miss your carbon targets. So then the question, it seems to me, is lower emission acceptable when your target is no emission, right? And so what's your alternative? So you have a priority ranking of things that are common sense to do. And the first is to change the slope of demand. I don't think there's any question about that. So there's huge amounts of efficiency that you need to put in the system, deploy, and get them up to speed immediately. You can accelerate that and assist in that by moving into renewables and deploying renewables, but there's still some scalability issues. So even if you assume 20%, 25%, of the system is renewables, then 75% of the system is something else. So if your primary goal is to back out coal until you have CCS, then it seems to me your near-term objectives are nuclear, which is not really a near-term objective, or natural gas. So it's just you have to put things in a timeline and put things into connection with cost. You may down the road decide that electrification of the system, if you're going to go with distributed energy or fuel cells, is not particularly the way to go. And transportation, I would argue, is different from power generation, so they're distinctly different issues. I mean, the security issue is an oil-related issue, petroleum-based for transportation fuels. Natural gas, not so much right now on the security side in terms of importation, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be an issue in the future. So I just think we have to be smart about it. There's time and advancements that we need to take into consideration. Our whole thrust through this study effort is to do smart things now to put yourself in position and get you on the glide path and promote technology and see what you can get, mindful that you've got environmental constraints.
Michael, did you want
to? Just a couple of things. First, I'm not the transportation expert, but we work with the transportation experts at EIA quite a bit. And two observations I have to make that they make all the time, which is it's a numbers game. You're starting from a very low level of market acceptance, and you're trying to get consumers to buy a lot of these to replace the fleet of vehicles that are already in the ground. So you have a time scale issue involved and a promotion time scale as well. So is it a clear choice for consumers to make? And will they make that choice? And how long will it take for you to get a significant portion of the vehicle stock replaced to electrification? The other aspect, and this is kind of the interesting carrot here, is that in the end use of, let's say, a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle or an electric vehicle, you don't actually end up consuming a whole lot of the fuels that go into the electrification. You do most of your energy losses in the conversion to the electricity, but when you take into account the transmission and distribution losses and the charging of the vehicle and then the conversion of that energy into vehicle miles traveled, you actually get something of a savings there. At least from what I've observed.
This actually came up. We had a session here a couple weeks ago on transforming the transportation sector that looked at a lot of these questions for scalable solutions or scalable systems for sort of transforming the transportation sector. And CNG has been getting a lot of attention as a potential new market for natural gas producers, but also a contributor to oil demand reduction in the transportation sector, emissions reduction in the transportation sector. It's been sort of a very active debate, and it's a sort of unsatisfying answer about sort of the near-term potential of switching to one particular fuel or the other, and it sort of harkens back to we were talking about after the transportation sector event, the biofuels discussion, you know, where there are places in this country where biofuels makes a lot of sense, and the infrastructure for E85 or all ethanol vehicles makes a heck of a lot of sense. And I think the same is true for probably CNG. Right now, electrification just seems to have sort of a broader applicability. Its infrastructure requirements really sort of match up with the decarbonizing of the electric power sector as well. So there's a lot of sort of overlay between those two parts too. Alulu?
Middle of this decade, we are talking about gas destruction mainly in the industrial sector. And if you look at the fundamentals right now and those forecasts, if natural gas will be abundant, are we expecting the fertilizers coming back instead of keeping, dismantling their factory and sending, shipping it to China or the Middle East?
That's a good question.
I think it depends on whether or not you believe the big resource play and the regulation in the United States will be attractive for fertilizers and petrochemicals to stay here, or you want to be closer to what you believe is a more convenient and volumetrically attractive production source. And I actually think that the shale play is kind of a game changer. If you go back even 24 months where we were looking at forecasting and you look at the potential here, it's caused many people, and you know this, to reevaluate where you are and where you need to be or where you want to be.
Is that something?
Well, and I just would like to underline that where you would like to put these industries, fertilizer, et cetera, is where the lowest cost feedstock would be. And quite frankly, given the cost of the unconventional, some of these locations, as Alulu knows, is outside the U.S. borders.
Thank you. My name is Kevin Easley, and I'm with the EPA Policy Office. And I wanted to hear the panel's views on just how low carbon is unconventional natural gas in terms of current state of technology and going forward. To me, it seems to be sort of this canary in the coal mine in that some preliminary work we've done in the policy office indicates that there's a vast amount of carbon associated with getting it out of the ground and getting it to the clean burning fuel that's at your oven, for example.
That means you'd like to take it.
Well, let me comment by just saying we're reviewing with a great deal of interest the analysis of life cycle production of natural gas. But at the current time, we're not explicitly modeling that aspect except as, you know, testing and evaluating where these directions might go. It's a very interesting area. It's an area that has a great deal of controversy, as many people know, and we're following it quite closely, attending the workshops, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm good.
Well, I was just going to add, I mean, that clearly that the energy needed to get the resource out of the ground does need to be accounted in the accounting. I do just want to flag the distinction between oil shale and gas shale. I think we know that the extraction of oil shale is incredibly energy intensive and also requires an incredible amount of water. My understanding is that, and maybe on the next panel there'll be some more expertise to address this, I think that the drilling in terms of the energy requirements, drilling to get gas
unconventional gas is not significantly different than the conventional gas in terms of the energy needed to get it out of the ground.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add with my CSIS hat, we would love to see your modeling on life cycle.
I have not been modeling on life cycle.
Okay. No, but I think Michael's point, and I think Sharon would agree, that this is an issue. It's contentious. It's built on assumptions, but we're going to have to get our arms around it at some point. So looking at what's out there would be a most informative tool, I think.
Yeah, I'll also add in the workshops that we had in the research coming up to the paper that we wrote, this was one of the areas where we found very, very little information. I mean, very few people have looked at it inside industry and academia. There's a few studies on the life cycle impact of LNG, but very little on unconventionals, and we put it as a recommendation just to start getting your arms around it so we don't sort of run into the same biofuels issue that we're currently dealing with today. So. Right. Is there a question over here before? I'm sorry. I can't remember to look to my left.
Hi, I'm Paul Parfumak with CRS. How realistic is it to expect that the shale plays will be able to continue using the water the way they do and putting the stuff in the water that they are putting in now over the next 20 years?
Yeah. Okay, so conversations that we've had with service companies, and I was in the industry for 25 years, there's a movement towards using less water. There are material safety data sheets that all companies put out that show component pieces of what they store on site, and some of this is for local fire and health officials. Now, I take the point about proprietary combinations for what you, as an individual service company, what you use in your fracking fluid, right? So maybe there needs to be more disclosure on that or a better understanding of what that is. Over time, the industry, and this is a historical model, that the industry has usually decreased costs, become more efficient, found better ways to do stuff as they understand the geology and understand the above ground issues. And there's even more environmental pressure to be more aware and sensitive and conform with what societal demands are. I don't think anyone questions that. So, I mean, tending in that direction, if you want to stay in business, you're going to have to do that.
Sharon, did you want to answer that? Or? You're good? Okay. Yes.
Sean O'Keefe with Boyd & Gray and Associates. I was just wondering, is there anything that Europe is doing that we could implement, and also any ideas on the Piggins plan?
Ideas that you'd like to share, that is.
There are unconventional gas plays in Europe, in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Turkey, some around the Black Sea that I think have potential. It's just we're at the early stages. The only comment on the Pickens plan, one of the things that we tried to do in this paper was to look at kind of best use. And to us, the use electricity generated from natural gas is more efficient and it's lower carbon than using CNG in vehicles. The infrastructure required to put CNG in vehicles is hugely costly. There's 172,000 retail stations. There's about 800 gas refueling stations. Retrofitting the cars in Europe, they've got LNG switches or CNG switches, but they also have conventional gasoline. If you're limited in supply or you're concerned about supply and you want to have adequacy, that you don't want petrochemical producers, fertilizer producers, heating and cooling, electricity generation folks, and then depending what you're going to do with the transportation sector, it's just that you need to balance them out. For fleet use, I think it's a great idea. You know, if you've got a storage tank the size of this table and you're a bus, have at it. For a commuter car, if it's a cab that refuels in the same place every night, I think that's fine. I think for personal autos, it's just, at this stage, doesn't make a lot of sense. There's other better uses.
I'll just add, and that's completely consistent with NRDC's analysis, and we've actually done some work with T-Bone Pickens and the people working with him, and I think they've actually evolved to closer to recognizing the role that the fleet can have. But I think it also goes back to the point that you made, that there really isn't a silver bullet in the sense that one supply is going to solve all our answers, solve all our problems. And I think that's why I think the debate in terms of there has been a lot growing discussion around natural gas and looking to these conventional sources. Again, we acknowledge the role of natural gas going forward because we can't get all the answers in one place. But I think it also is a mistake, and I really valued this discussion in terms of highlighting some of the limits. It's a mistake to just see it as, and I think there are some natural gas promoters out there that see it as the solution to the climate challenge, and that's going to take us down a path that's going to cause a lot of problems.
Mitzi.
I don't know. Are there any infrastructure issues related to pipelines? I mean, if you have this enormous expansion on the availability of natural gas, do we have a mechanism for delivering it, or do we have to do a lot of expansion?
Well, I'll address that to a degree. The natural gas industry has an advantage over the electric industry in that much of its infrastructure is buried under the ground. When people can't see it, they don't necessarily complain that much. As a result, it's usually quite straightforward to site new gas transmission lines. The largest of these projects has been the REX pipeline that's crossed from the Rockies and is seeking to access eastern markets. And that project has moved ahead and has helped allow for that bubble of gas in the mid-continent to access markets. One of the advantages and the disadvantages of some of these gas shale plays, such as Marcellus, being close to infrastructure allows it to be easily transportable to those markets if it can be produced or when it can be produced. And some of these other plays, such as the Haynesville, already are lying underneath quite a bit of gas transmission capability. So, in essence, lacking a dramatic increase in consumption patterns elsewhere in the U.S., the infrastructure looks fairly robust.
I'll just add, I think there are safety issues and concerns that come with the if you're having to if you're increasing the overall supply, you are increasing the amount of pipeline capacity, and I would agree that it hasn't, especially compared to potential controversy around exciting transmission lines, which is also a big issue we're now dealing with. I think siting is not as problematic, but I do think there is a potential issue for communities around safety issues because, again, we've seen it, and, you know, one incident is enough to really generate a lot of concern and fear. So I think in addition to the siting issues, addressing and ensuring the safety is important as the expansion of the pipelines that is needed goes forward.
Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant. Notwithstanding the clarity of the explanations of the issues, this afternoon. There are among the producers and the transporters and users, brokers that broker the energy. There are programs for carbon credits, and I'm wondering if there are financial instruments and financial practices that don't really consider the issues that we're discussing here in terms of environment and efficiency, but which are more just financial instruments that could lead to disruptions in treating the policies that are in place now and the research that's being done to try to deal with them. Is there a sort of a Wall Street aspect to this that could be a surprise due to these derivatives or other instruments dealing with gas prices, mm-hmm. energy prices?
Let me try to take a stab at that. So when we look at the oil market and we look at what we call fundamentals, you know, supply and demand geopolitics, clearly something beyond the fundamentals is occurring. I mean, if you look at stock overhang and other things, there's not justification for prices where they are. Recognizing that, if there's one thing we learned out of the last 2 years, it's that elasticities still matter, right? So gasoline, when it got to 375, was pretty effective. We thought it was at 3, but we were off. The leads and lag time of the business cycle are still very much alive. We overinvest, we underinvest. We do that all the time. And then I think the third piece was that these non-fundamental, whether it's embracing an optimistic view on economic growth, right, or moving dollars into commodities. So if you're actually hedging on the bet that in a carbon-constrained world, you can't scale up nuclear, efficiency in low-price environment may not get you there, technology for CCS is still a ways off, I think you will actually see commodities moving into natural gas. One of the things that may offset it is the size of the resource base. But is there ample room for manipulation? Carbon credits, I don't think we've even begun to figure out. This could be like Ticketron. You know, if anybody's tried to go to the Kennedy Center recently, if it's a good show, all the tickets are gone, and you pay $250 for, you know, a seat at something that should be $56. So there's other things occurring in the market, but money is moving. The value of the dollar. So is there peril in this future? Sure. I think, you know, Congress and the FTC and other folks are trying to get their arms around it. I always thought that the business moves faster than the regulation, just as a matter of course, so we'll just kind of have to see. Do you have any thoughts on that? Sure.
I don't.
Well, EIA's corporate view is that speculation... I'm sure you've spoken with Guy quite a bit on this. Speculation is not the primary determinant of prices, clearing in markets, supply and demand. And it is true that there is a lot of interest in these markets, and there are those who are participating in these markets who are neither intending to produce the gas or sell or consume the gas. Over the longer term, though, such as, you know, when I'm currently thinking about the existing natural gas market as it's currently structured, the market is in what's called a contango, which looks like people are expecting natural gas prices to be much higher than they are currently sometime in the future. And this has led to something of an ongoing continuation of and flattening out of rig rates. This may actually be positive for the market in terms of dampening out what would otherwise be a wilder roller coaster ride in terms of an industry correction in these natural gas markets. Be that as it may, at some point producers and consumers will have to work things out, and at some point, if the infrastructure can no longer take in all this gas, there'll be a rather dramatic correction to the markets.
Thanks. Dick Bonatta from the Science and Technology Policy Institute. Frank, I'm going to pick on you because you said something kind of heroic, in a sense, saying there is a need for regulatory policy, strategy, plan for transition. Begging the question, in this government, who does that?
Have anyone here from the government?
No.
not the EIA.
Oh, nice.
I think there's an attempt to get their arms around this. So I've been harsh on the government at different times. They're 5 months into it, right? There's not a lot of people. If you go back 3 weeks, the only confirmed person at DOE was Secretary Chu. Yeah, that's what I mean. So things are progressively moving. I think things have changed, and we talked about this a little bit at an earlier session, and with the idea that if you go back to the election campaign, this is both candidates, 2007, 2008, markedly different price environment. A lot of the policies were predicated on a continuation of higher price, reducing balance of payments, improving security, reducing imports, moving technology and renewables, and then we moved them into jobs creation because that became job one. So I think this is an evolving piece. We're still looking at Copenhagen at the end of the year. There's a big environmental push out there. There's a lot of money in the stimulus package to do different things. My sense is, and this is just a personal sense, so it's not CSIS corporate policy either, there's a pragmatic approach when decisions have to be made, whether it's the Canadian situation, what happened in Turkey, even the situation in Iran. Failing that, the administration tends to fall back on campaign rhetoric because the policies were already put in place and that's what helped them got elected. And up until the last month, I think low energy prices have allowed a lot of these energy issues to be a little bit back burner. So, but I that doesn't go on forever. But if you're looking for a locus within the administration, I think it's disparate places. It's at state, it's at the White House, it's at the agencies.
Okay, well, in the interest of saving time for our next panel, I'm going to wrap up with that. I know we've got a lot more questions that we could ask. But we're going to take a quick 5-minute break so you can get some coffee and some dessert. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you to help thank this excellent panel for their contributions.
I'll run up and pull them up.
Thank you.
If I could call everyone back from the painfully short break, that would be great. We'll get started in just a minute here. Yeah, that would be great. Okay, I think we're going to try and get started. If everyone could take their seats, please. Thanks very much. Okay, thanks very much. First, I just want to introduce myself. My name is Debbie Boger. I'm the director of U.S. Climate Policy at the World Resources Institute. And very first, I want to thank Sarah and Frank and CSIS for having us over this afternoon. And also to say that WRI's partnership with CSIS over the last year and a half, I think, has been very fruitful, and it's been very interesting for me. We produced a roadmap that Sarah and Frank have both mentioned that I feel like really, it's been an interesting discussion and an important one, really informing policymakers who are trying to balance some of the priorities in energy security and climate in a way that has been insightful, I think. And the good news is that we've been able to identify kind of the sweet spot, the center of Frank's circles and triangle that he showed, I think, in a very helpful way, in addition to dealing with some of the more trade-off type of issues. So I encourage you all to pick up a copy of this roadmap on your way out if you haven't seen it. And just very quickly, also wanted to give you a sense of the World Resources Institute. We are a nonprofit think tank. We actually like to refer to ourselves as a do tank rather than a think tank, in that we try to do robust technical analysis on issues that will actually inform real-time policymaking. And so with that, I'd like to turn to our panel this afternoon, and we are going to discuss some of the technological and policy implications of some of the issues that were laid out from our first panel. And I'd like to introduce our two distinguished guests to discuss some of these implications. First, we have to my immediate right, Revis James, who is the director of EPRI's Energy Technology Assessment Center, focusing mostly on identifying strategic research and development priorities for the electric power industry. And further along down the table, we have David Trice, who is the chairman of America's Natural Gas Alliance and is responsible for overseeing the alliance's mission and strategic initiatives. So with that, I'll turn it over to Revis, and we're going to try and save 20, 30 minutes at the end for your questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Debbie. What I'd like to do in my remarks is not give you more information on natural gas and its characteristics or where it can be found or how easy it can be recovered, but rather talk a little bit about the utility industry's perspectives on natural gas and some observations about a world in which, if we were relying a lot more on natural gas, how the industry might respond to that, and some of the concerns and some of the opportunities we see. So the first thing I'd like to do is calibrate everyone to the way we think about any technology, including natural gas, and that is that we basically don't like volatility. We like reliability. So we're looking for technologies, and we like things that last for a really, really long time. So we're looking for things that can produce electricity on a reliable level with a fairly predictable price for a long, long period of time. And where we cannot do that, we try to hedge risks either through financial strategies or by diversifying the technologies. And so, and as you all know, a lot of times in the financial space, that's difficult to do. So we tend to like a lot of technology diversity for that reason. And so my perspectives are pretty much grounded in a portfolio point of view, and looking at natural gas as an element of a portfolio of different things. And the questions that we ask are usually, what are the right proportions for different technologies? Okay, so with that, let's see if we can move on. So a quick word about Electric Power Research Institute. I think maybe a lot of people here may know what EPRI is, but in case you don't, we're a nonprofit research foundation that was founded in the early 1970s. We're principally funded by utility companies. Most of them, about 85% of those companies, are from the United States, but about 50% are international. And the concept of what EPRI is doing is applied research. We're not doing basic physics, but we're working on power plant technologies, transmission distribution, environmental issues associated with the delivery and use of electricity, all the issues that relate to the whole food chain of electricity. And our goals are basically to try and address that pyramid or that triangle that Frank had up there, which I think was really good. Basically, economically sustainable, something that's technically sustainable over a long period of time, and it's compatible with the environmental requirements that we're trying to meet. We're about 800 people, and the model that we have is collaborative research. Everybody's putting their money in a pot, and research is being done together, and results are being shared. That's a central model. And we work with a lot of different organizations here in Washington and around the country. We've worked with EIA in a few areas. So what I decided to do here is take a look first at a couple of interesting numbers. So I was looking at the potential gas committee report, which I think has been mentioned in some of the earlier presentations. And these are some of the numbers that come from that report. And just one remark I want to make there is that the potential resources that are identified in that report are comprehensive, meaning that some of the resources are going to be expensive to recover and some will be less costly to recover. And if you take a look at the amount of energy represented by the shale gas potential, I did a few calculations to try and compare that to what the electricity production demands might be. So this is a chart depicting over the last decade or so what the trends are in natural gas consumption from different consumption sectors. In particular, the red line is the one interesting to us, obviously, the electric sector. And historically, we've been seeing a rise in that consumption. What we have done over the last few years has been we've been looking at the impact that different policies might have on the generation technology portfolio. And one of the more interesting ones that we've done is analysis of CO2 emissions constraints and what that might do. These two charts you're looking at here are a comparison of two very different technology strategies done in 2007. So the costs are a little bit out of date, but I think the relative comparison between the two scenarios is still valid. The left-hand side there, called the limited portfolio, is a reference to the fact that that portfolio was premised on the idea that we would have a CO2 emissions constraint that would require emissions to be flat from 2010 to 20, that we would then reduce our emissions as an economy, an overall economy, 3% a year, and that we would not have a significant expansion of nuclear power, either for financial limitations or concerns about proliferation, and we would also not have any significant CO2 capture and storage, mainly due either to liability concerns about CO2 storage or due to technology difficulties, too much of an energy penalty for use of CO2 capture in coal plants. And in that type of scenario, if you ask the question, how can I most economically meet that specified CO2 emissions constraint, you can calculate a mix of technologies over time that will do that. And This chart on the left, these colors represent different technologies. The orange one there is natural gas. And you can see that natural gas, along with reducing electricity demand through efficiency and conservation, are very, very large players in how you would meet the emissions constraint in that case. The right-hand chart is an alternative scenario where you postulate successful development of CO2 capture and storage technology, commercial availability of CO2 storage on a large scale, and the financial and policy ability to expand nuclear power. And in that case, you get a lot of nuclear, a lot of coal CCS, and still some significant demand reduction to meet the same exact constraint. I want to focus on the left-hand one for a moment, because in that particular scenario, we're looking at a lot of natural gas, and I wanted to estimate some things about how much gas we would need and compare that to some of the resources that we've been talking about earlier today. So if you look at this chart, these two red lines that you're seeing, well, I guess it's a red line and a black line near the bottom there, those two lines represent the trajectory for the amount of natural gas we would use over time per year for the limited portfolio, which is the upper curve, and the full portfolio, which is the lower curve. And there are a couple of interesting insights from this chart that I think are worth discussing. One is, of course, that the natural gas consumption obviously is a lot higher for the limited portfolio because of the reliance on natural gas. And the vertical axis of the chart is in percent relative to year 2000 as a reference. So, for example, that peak, maybe I can use the mouse here and even indicate this. I'm coordinated enough to do this with my left hand. If the peak up here out in 2040, that's about 375% of the natural gas used in 2000. That's what the level would be for that particular scenario in year 2040. And I'll talk about how much gas it implies here in a moment. The lower line there in the shaded region represents the trajectory for the use of natural gas in the full portfolio case with those other technologies having the opportunity to expand. So one takeaway we have from this kind of analysis, and there have been many analyses like this by others and EPRI for other types of scenarios, is that diversity in technology tends to make us less dependent on any one fuel, and there are a few remarks I'll make about that, why we think that is good not to have too much of a dependence on any one fuel. The shaded region there is an uncertainty range around that full portfolio that has to do with the implications of different costs for nuclear power or CCS technologies, CCS, CO2 capture and storage, because those baseload technologies have a tremendous impact on what you need from natural gas, renewables, and efficiency in the remainder of the mix. Now, one question you can ask about this chart is, well, what would happen if I added up the amount of gas that I would need to use over those decades for that upper curve, just to get an idea of whether or not a strategy where a reliance on natural gas is viable. So a couple of observations from that. Just look at the bottom bullet there for a second. Basically, if you integrate under that curve, you would get, roughly speaking, about 600 or so trillion cubic feet of natural gas consumption over that period of time. And that's it's a little bit more, but it's about equal to what the potential gas committee estimated as the shale gas component of the reserves. Those figures were mentioned earlier today. So that's a lot of energy, and that is a very good thing, conceivably, that we might be able to meet a tremendous amount of gas consumption from that one resource. But you would pretty much eat that resource up by 2050. So from a utility perspective, well, that sounds like a long time. 2050 is really not a very long time. That's essentially 40 years from now. 40 years is about enough time to that's essentially two or less cycles of building power plants and transmission lines and getting them out there in the field. So that's not a very long time for us. So a resource that will carry us for a couple of cycles is good but not great. So we would want to see, even if we could do this, we would want to see other resources available in order to meet the demand. Keep in mind when you consider the power sector that on top of where we are today in our consumption, we are projecting some basic growth in demand, even in light of the economic conditions that we have. So that demand growth is not trivial. For example, the EIA's annual energy outlook for 2009, the revised version that's adjusted downward a little bit for some of the factors in the economy, projects, roughly speaking, about 24% demand growth for electricity by 2030. And to give you an idea how much energy that would be the same as adding California, Texas, Florida, and Ohio to our existing energy consumption, electricity consumption. So that's a lot of energy. It's a lot of infrastructure, a lot of power plants, a lot of transmission lines, a lot of meters, a lot of things. So we're going to need to provide, we feel that we're going to need a lot of resources to meet that kind of demand, even if we are able to rely on gas to a very large extent. So that's one observation. Another set of observations is that for planning purposes, if you look at these top few bullets here on this chart, for planning purposes, we're making decisions right now about the year 2030 in the sector. We're planning what power plants we're going to build over the next decade or two, or projects are being laid out on the books. Even those that are not in filing yet are in the planning stages right now, including large-scale plants, coal plants, and nuclear plants. So the next 5 years are pivotal with respect to what we're going to be doing in 2030. And so making decisions about natural gas, among other resources, is pivotal. And so naturally there's a tendency to not want to be too reliant on any one resource, because if you're wrong, your ability to recover is very limited because of the lead times necessary to develop this infrastructure. Another perspective that I'd just like to offer is the timing of when these different technologies are going to be available. And this is an area where I would say natural gas is particularly important and helpful, along with efficiency and renewables. Even if we are successful in, say, a full portfolio type of world, a world where we could have a substantial expansion of nuclear power and the smart grid, which would enable a lot of efficiency, and CO2 capture and storage, the likelihood that those technologies will penetrate to a large scale is probably not for at least 10 years or more. So that interregnum, that period of 10 years, is going to have to be bridged by something, because we're going to experience some growth, CO2 policy during that same period of time, and we obviously expect natural gas to be the significant player there. And a lot of our member organizations, which, as I said, are many utility companies, are definitely planning for that. You add on top of that the fact that financing power plants is a fundamental limitation for planning now. People just can't borrow that much money, and so a lower capital intensity technology is desirable, thus a preference for gas plants from that standpoint, even if lifetime costs under CO2 policy are sometimes calculated to be cheaper with other options. Gas is the technology that's being looked at right now for the immediate plants. Oh, and I'd like to make one remark about transportation, because I heard a question that was in the first panel about transportation. This is just a side remark, but I wanted to add a little bit. We've done an analysis where we've looked at what the potential is of different technology strategies to reduce CO2 emissions from the electric sector. And we've done one type of analysis, which we've named the PRISM. Some of you may have seen this chart, a kind of a colorful wedge chart that illustrates these potentials. We estimated what we thought the potential for reducing emissions from electrifying transportation would be. And just a data point, if you were to electrify, if by 2030 about 30% of all new vehicles, not all vehicles, all new vehicles, were PHEVs, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, you would see some net reductions in CO2 emissions, because you would gain more in losing tailpipe emissions than you would put back due to increased electricity consumption. The magnitude of electricity consumption for that would be around 160 terawatt hours. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but I can give you a number to compare that to. Total U.S. electricity consumption is 3,800 terawatt hours in 2007. So 160 terawatt hours for 30% of all new PHEVs in 2030 is a lot of energy, but it's by no means going to turn the electricity sector upside down. So I don't think the electricity consumption related to electric vehicles is going to be the dominant factor in the deployment of those vehicles. It's going to be other considerations. Okay, just a few conclusions. First, some general conclusions about the portfolio. We don't think there are going to be any silver bullets. We think you're going to need some diversity. Just an observation I like to make is that there isn't time today to go over some of the other analysis that we've done, but much of our economic and energy analysis, which has been duplicated by others, indicates that a portfolio of technologies that's fairly balanced tends to be a cheaper way to achieve a given level of CO2 emissions reduction. So from a financial standpoint, that looks like a preferable strategy. The second comment I'll make is the comment as an engineer. I'm an engineer, not an economist, even though I've got an education in that the last couple of years. What I would just say is that stuff never works out the way you planned. Nothing ever gets built as fast as you thought. Deadlines are always quicker than you want them to be. So you need to have some backup in different technologies so that you can respond and be resilient in the face of unexpected developments. I mean, I'm not a geologist, but you know, if you have drilling problems or you have problems in trying to run coal plants or gas plants at higher process conditions, and you have material problems that you never anticipated or you underestimated, you need to have diversity in order to respond to that. So from our perspective, it's very, very, very important to have technology diversity, because you need to have the ability to maintain and operate a fleet of assets that you will outlive all of your suppliers and contractors who provided you everything. You will have to be the expert. The analogy I like to draw is that you buy a car, and you're going to have to become an expert in all the welding, all the plastics, all the electronics in that car, because there ain't going to be anybody else to explain that to you by the time that car reaches the end of its life. So we like diversity when we're faced with that kind of those kind of challenges. The other comment I want to make is that if you look at some of the analysis that we've done, the ability to decarbonize electricity production has a very, very big impact on the cost of reducing CO2 emissions, because decarbonized electricity provides an avenue for other sectors of the economy to decarbonize more economically. So it's definitely desirable to have a portfolio that takes you to that decarbonized electricity state for that reason. It's not solely to reduce emissions in the electric sector. Okay, so I think I'll just let it go there, and we can answer more questions later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Revis. As we did before, we're going to hold questions until the end of the session. So now I'd like to introduce David Trice with the American Natural Gas Alliance.
Thank you, Debbie, and I want to thank CSIS for having us here today. Debbie told you that I'm the chairman of ANGA, or ANGA as we call it. My real job, I retired from about a month ago, is CEO and chairman of Newfield Exploration Company, which is a natural gas producer located in Houston, Texas. And Houston's been my home for the last 30 years, and I've been in the natural gas business for the last 30 years. So the danger of being the last guy on the podium is, one, everybody's tired or they've left, or two, that a lot has already been said. But there's a big puzzle that we're talking about, how to have a balanced strategy, how to put all the pieces together. So I hope some of what I have to share with you this afternoon will maybe fill in a couple more pieces of that puzzle. Let me just tell you a little bit about who the America's Natural Gas Alliance is. This is a newly formed organization. Our kickoff meeting was March 12, 2009. We formed this organization really because of the way this meeting was introduced today. It's that a few months ago, nobody was talking about natural gas. We've been very successful in developing an abundant resource. We became very concerned as an industry about 6 months ago that as we were discussing energy policy, as we were discussing climate change policy, that natural gas, which in our mind should be a cornerstone of those policies, wasn't at the table. So we formed this organization. There are 26 current members. We're going to keep it relatively small. We're all independent E&P companies. We're located in the U.S. and Canada. We represent 8 to 9 TCF of production. That's on a net basis. If you look at what we operated, it would be substantially more than that. That's about, if we look at it just in U.S. terms, about 40% of all the natural gas that's produced in the U.S. on a daily basis is 30% of all the gas that's produced in North America. We are basically the guys that are developing and discovering these resource plays. That comment was made earlier today. Let me just reinforce it. It's not Exxon. It's not Shell. It's not Chevron. Every one of these plays, our companies are the ones that created them. We're the ones that are developing those plays. We're the ones that are bringing the gas to the market. We're the ones spending all the mega dollars to make these plays happen. So we're all independents, and there's some significant differences about the way we run our business as U.S. and Canadian independents than the way our brothers in the major side do. Let me also, before I forget, I want to introduce Rod Lohman. Rod's the president of ANGA. He's located here in Washington, D.C., and I think he's got some materials for you on the organization. It'll give you a full list of our members. You'll see on there they're companies you will have heard of. They're all the top independent producers in North America. But Rod's here to be a resource for you, so make sure you get his card and call on him and not the chairman. I'm not paid. He is. I'm doing this as a voluntary basis because I believe in natural gas. I believe what it can do for this country, and our voice needs to be heard, and that's why we're formed. I won't go through this mission statement, but basically we were formed to preach the mission of abundance and the benefits of natural gas. We talked about those a lot today, but fundamentally we're here as an education organization. There are a lot of issues that have been talked about today. I would have liked to have responded to a lot of the great questions that were raised after the first panel, and I'm sure I'll get my chance on some of them today. But we're here to inform, to work with you, to figure out ways where there are issues, to educate, and if there are still gaps, we'll figure out how to work together. We're here to be a resource. We're going to set up our website. It's up and running now. It's going to become a much more valuable tool for you to understand what's going on in natural gas business, how we extract the resource, and some of the issues that surround that. But again, we want to be a resource and an educational tool for people around the country, inside the Beltway and out. Rod and I were at a meeting of the Natural Gas Council at the end of March, and Secretary Salazar was good enough to show up at that meeting and share some remarks with us. And he started out by listing the fundamental principles of the Obama administration's energy and climate change policy. And he ticked them off, and he said, number one was energy independence. And he said, we understand the limitations of energy independence. There's a realism there, which was good to hear. Two was, anything we do, American opportunity. Jobs in America, revenues for America. And number three was the reality of climate change. So when he finished going through those, we had a Q&A session, and I told him that, you know, you really ought to love natural gas because it can make a significant contribution to each and every one of the principles that you just outlined. And he made the comment that, well, we're doing something about that. We're trying to open up the eastern Gulf of Mexico. And that totally misses the point. The point is we've already proved gas is abundant. The shales are real. It's not just shales. I'll talk about some of the other plays that are going on. It's any tight gas sands that we, or sands or shales or carbonates that we can access with a drill bit and do it horizontally today, do it safely, do it reliably with due regard for the environment. So our view is that natural gas is not just a bridge. It should be the foundation of both energy and climate change policy because it can make a difference, and we have a lot of it, and we can deliver it to the marketplace. But if you want to think of it as a bridge, that's fine with us. Just think of it as a real strong bridge that goes a long, long way. So let's talk about those policy implications, and I'll go through each of them. I've got a couple of maps to show that you've seen, so we can go through those pretty quickly. But, well, it's abundant. You've heard that already today. Key thing we really haven't talked about, it's American. And we can create a lot of opportunity here in America by proper exploitation of the resource that's essentially already proved. There's a lot more to be assessed behind the plays that have been talked about that go into those analysis of the 100-year supply. If you look at the potential out there, it's not recorded yet, and we think the supply is going to be substantially greater than that. People think about natural gas. They think Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and the offshore. I think it was mentioned earlier today, 34 states. We got 32 when we counted, but it will take 34. Natural gas touches a lot of places. It creates jobs in a lot of places here in America, but it's not just those three states. We're producing natural gas throughout the United States today and throughout the western provinces in Canada and even in the eastern provinces. And places that produce a lot of coal have a greater future in natural gas, both in terms of jobs and revenue for local states. Frank went through it. Frank, you talk like a geologist. You're great. Enjoyed your presentation today. The 100-year supply number, a lot of studies out, the potential gas committee study. We're going to do our own study out here because we've got the real data. So we've commissioned ICF to do a study, which we hope we'll have up by next October or November, that we can give you even better information and more reliable information for what we can deliver, how fast we can deliver, and at what prices we need to make that delivery. So that study is underway. It's being done by an independent third party. It'll be funded by us, and it'll be our data, but it'll be the real data. It won't just be looking at the resource and trying to understand number of sections and thicknesses of formations, of doing some math to try to get what the resource is. We can be a lot more specific, and we'll do that. So just on terms of abundancy, you've seen the map of the shale plays. Again, if we tick through the list that's on the map, I could tell you that the leading players in that are members of ANGA, and the dominant players in each and every one of those plays are members of ANGA. The map on the right-hand side of the slide just shows you the dramatic growth, and this is just shales. And keep in mind, when we're talking about unconventional plays, it's not just shales. It's tight gases and other things. But look at the explosion in shale gas over the last decade. You can see we went from about 1.5 BCF a day to about 8 BCF a day. And as Ben mentioned, the Barnett was the dominant player in that. And if you look at the explosion of the Barnett, that happened because we put a lot of rigs to work, and we got smarter the way we put those rigs to work. Instead of drilling vertical wells, Devin, who's the leader in that place, started drilling horizontal wells. At first, they were short laterals. Now we're drilling laterals up to 10,000 feet, and it does reduce the footprint. That was a question that was raised earlier today. It reduces the footprint in every single shale play that we drill. We drill from pads. Instead of drilling 16 wells or more per section, we're probably going to drill 6 wells per section. It makes a difference in footprint in everything we do. Most of these other plays are basically progeny of the Barnett. When the Barnett was discovered and you had this resource, it was repeatable. It covered a huge area. And scale is very important. Scale has been talked about in CCS today, but scale is important in gas plays. When we used to look for natural gas fields in the Gulf of Mexico or onshore U.S., we were talking 500 acres or 1,000 acres. The Marcellus covers 20 million acres. The Woodford, which is a play my company leads, covers about 1.2 million acres. I don't know the counts in the other plays. We're talking about massive plays that are proved and have a lot of drilling left to be done where we can access the resource and bring it to the U.S. So if you think about that map, you just think about those layers continuing to increase, and that's really what shale can do for us over the next 50 to 100 years in terms of gas supply. So it's not just shale, though. Unconventional plays, and I'm not going through a map of those, will do it. Will do the same thing for us in the U.S. This next slide basically just shows the explosion from horizontal drilling. There have been basically three keys to the development of shale gas and other non-conventional plays in the U.S. Higher prices. Devon started making the Barnett economic at $3. That was in a different cost environment. These wells are difficult to drill. They're deep for the most part. We drill long laterals, and we do fracture stimulation of those wells. What I wanted to point out is not only the yellow part of the chart that shows you the explosion in shale gas production, but at what price it was done. The red line is the rig count. You can see the rig count responded at about $5 gas. And most of that time, we were looking at $6 to $8 gas. And keep in mind, $6 to $8 gas is equivalent to $36 to $48 oil. So gas is pretty cheap when we compare it to some of the alternatives that are out there. So it doesn't take stratospheric prices to allow us to go out and exploit this resource. We can do that. We can do this at very reasonable prices, and we can deliver the low-carbon fuel to the industry. The reason we can do it quickly is demonstrated here. It's basically that as an industry, we get smarter when we do things over and over and over again. We not only bring our costs down, but we've learned how to produce our wells so that we get higher rates and we get better recoveries, and that leads to better economics. The green line on this chart represents the Barnett Shale. It took a long time for the Barnett to they played around with the Barnett for a long time before they could make it commercial. Rates from the Barnett were pretty low initially from vertical wells. You had to drill a lot of them. The real explosion in Barnett started about 3 years ago when we went in with horizontal drilling. And the Barnett went from producing about maybe 500 million a day to as high as 4.5 BCF a day, which is 6% of total U.S. gas production today. It's one shale play, and there are many shale plays out here. I just put on there two other plays to show you how different and how much faster they got to higher rates. The red line is the Woodford Shale. That's the one where my company's a dominant player. The purple line, I guess they show up on your graphs the same way, is the Fayetteville Shale in Arkansas. So basically you got the Barnett, you move to the northeast, you got the Woodford, you move to the east, you've got the Fayetteville Shale. We started with all the learnings that came from the Barnett Shale. We started with horizontal wells. We started, but we still had to learn, and we're now drilling those laterals out 9,000-10,000 feet, reducing our footprint, and bringing a lot more gas faster to the marketplace. You notice I don't have the Marcellus or the Haynesville on here. They've just started. The Haynesville now is very active. It's got about, I think, 40 to 50 rigs drilling in it. The Marcellus is producing, I think, less than 100 million cubic feet a day right now from the Marcellus, and that number may not be that high. It covers, as I said, 20 million acres. So the potential for the Barnett to be a gas resource in this country, the Marcellus, is huge, and we can do it quicker, and we can do it safely. So policy implication number two was talking about U.S. opportunity. We have a committee, a subcommittee of ANGA right now, where we've just awarded a contract. We really want to understand not only how many people do we directly employ in the natural gas business. That number is 1.8 million today. We think we add at least 3 million indirect jobs, and we suspect that our indirects are really a lot larger than that. We want to quantify that. Again, that's a study that we have underway. But we're a big employer, and we provide high-quality paying jobs throughout the U.S. We are a major contributor to the federal and state and local treasuries. We pay royalties, we pay taxes, we pay severance taxes, we pay permitting fees. And again, that's data that we want to quantify. I've heard, don't hold me to this, that the U.S. oil and gas business is the second largest source of funds to the Treasury. And I'm not sure whether that number is right or not. But again, we're going to quantify it. So the natural gas business is exceedingly important to the U.S., both from an employment and from a revenue standpoint. And we're doing it with a source that's homegrown, not where we're sending the money overseas for it. As we expand these resource plays throughout the U.S., we'll add more jobs, we'll pay more taxes, we'll create more economic opportunity here at home. And that, again, was part of this administration's policy, as announced by Secretary Salazar. On climate change, clearly, if you just put down the facts, natural gas is a winner. It's 44% less CO2 than coal. We produce almost no SOx or NOx. We don't produce any metals when you burn natural gas. And we don't have any residue left over. There are no piles of coal ash that sit around. So natural gas is a winner when we compare it to other carbon fuels out here. There's a question raised earlier. If you look, you know, throughout from the wellhead all the way through emission, it just is it's a relative basis. Compare that to coal and what it takes to mine coal. I will lay hands down that natural gas is the clear winner when we think about what we can do when we do have to have a balanced portfolio. And we're believers in that. We believe we need to have renewables, but, you know, the wind doesn't blow all the time. The sun doesn't shine all the time. It's got to be backed up. And frankly, there's not enough land to build all the solar and wind you'd want to have that be 50 or 60% of our energy supply. Natural gas has got to play a part of that. And the good thing is that the infrastructure already exists. We talked about pipeline infrastructure in an earlier panel. There actually exists more gas-fired capacity to generate electricity than there does coal plants. And I think the numbers are about 450 gigawatts of gas-fired capacity, and it's about 350 of coal. I think that's about right. But we use coal as baseload 70% of the time. We generate 50% of our electricity with coal. We use those gas plants between 20 and 25% of the time. We generate 20% of our electricity from natural gas. The plants already exist. The resource is abundant. We're connected to the grid, and we've got the pipeline system in shape. You can start increasing power generation from natural gas tomorrow. We can't do it all overnight, but we can sure add to the mix, and we can sure replace things that are a lot less clean burning than natural gas. Just quickly, threats to our business, and there are some out there, and that's another reason that we formed ANGA. We wanted to have a voice in what's going on here. I would tell you threat number one is climate change legislation that really doesn't recognize what should be the primacy of natural gas. And the existing legislation coming out of the House does not. It's negative to natural gas in our analysis. Again, that's another study we have underway. But with all the credits being given to coal and other industries, you'll be burning more coal in 2020 than you're burning today, and you'll be burning about the same amount of natural gas. That doesn't make sense to us if we're really serious about climate change. Increased taxation, royalties, fees, revenues on a natural gas business. Remember I indicated independents are different than majors. Independents reinvest every penny that we bring in from this business, and usually a lot more when the capital markets are accessible. So we're usually spending anywhere from 100 to 150%, maybe 200% of what we actually take in a year, reinvesting that, drilling wells in this country and creating jobs. If you increase taxes, if you increase royalty rates, there's less revenue, there's less wells drilled, there's less natural gas produced, and there's less jobs in the U.S. Overregulation, and questions were raised about that in the NRDC publication. And we're not afraid of regulation. I don't want anybody to have that idea. What I would commend you to do is read this recent DOE study. It's called a Modern Shale Gas Primer. development of shale gas plays in the U.S. It's a DOE publication. I think it went out. It's April 2009, so it's pretty much hot off the press. And half of this treatise is devoted to the abundancy of these shale plays. The other half is a review of all of the regulation that exists at a federal and state level. And in many cases, while the regulations and laws are federal, the states have been given primacy over that. Why is that? Because one-size-fits-all regulation doesn't work. Many of these things are done better at the state level. Most of them are already being done at the state level, and it's in our interest and as an industry to comply. Looking after water is 30% of our cost of running our business. The better we look after water, the more we can recycle it and reuse it, the lower our costs are. We're constantly working on that. And Sharon, I'd love to take you out and show you some things we're doing in the field to clean up water. And we're currently working with the EPA where we can take frack water, clean it back up, we think put it back in the fields, and the EPA is very excited about some of the things we're doing. So I don't worry about regulation. I worry about taking regulation that's better done at the state level, putting it at the federal level, where we just don't have the capacity to handle that permitting load at the federal level. Then the last thing, and this was pointed out a question in the last session about hedging. Most independents manage risk by hedging. We're not speculators. We own the commodity. We produce the commodity. And we're just like the corn guy that sells it out in the future. We do that with natural gas. We do that in my company all the time. This year, about 40% of our revenues are coming from the fact that we hedged out our gas at higher prices than we're experiencing today. If I didn't have the ability to do that, or I had to make mark-to-market margin calls, I wouldn't be able to do it because I don't run our business with that kind of working capital. It would eliminate my ability to hedge. This year, that's about $600 million of revenue I wouldn't have. That's $600 million of jobs and wells that we wouldn't drill. So basically, I would just like to conclude by telling you, I think you've heard the message of abundance. We're really happy to be hearing that in Washington these days because a few months ago, we weren't. It is homegrown. Keep that in mind. We do it here. It's jobs. But it does require all the stakeholders to get together and work together. And as an industry and as ANGA, we're prepared to do that. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, David. What I'd like to do now is open this up for questions. And just to reiterate the ground rules, if you could wait for the mic, and there are two of them coming around, and identify who you are and your organization, and then phrase your question with a question mark at the end, that would be great. So while you're thinking about your question, I actually wanted to kick us off with just two quick ones. One is there was a lot of discussion about needing more research on the climate impact specifically of the process. So if you know of any, if you could say them, that would be great because I know there's just a lot of questions around the room about what type of data in that vein exists. But my question is wanting to tie this a little bit more specifically to the current policy debate. David, you brought up some of the allocation concerns you have with the current legislation that's moving through the House right now, actually to be voted on as soon as Friday. But I'm just wondering if you could reflect on your reactions about the provisions in the Waxman-Markey bill as they relate specifically to the natural gas sector, if you have additional ones, or Revis, if you have any.
All right, just a couple of comments on your first question. Is work being done to assess, emissions at the wellhead or where we drill wells? Absolutely. I think every one of our member companies, or I think everyone, is in the process of doing a sustainability report. We're all going to have to measure our emissions at the well site and what it costs what we emit when we drill a well. That work is underway at our company, and I'm pretty sure it's underway at most of the larger companies in our group. So that work is being done. As far as a Waxman-Markey bill, I mean, I would have to plead in part ignorance. I mean, we've done an analysis that's being done by one of our subcommittees. We just don't see anything in that bill for natural gas other than negatives. Natural gas should be economically and on if we're thinking about climate change, a winner in climate change legislation, and we don't see that in this bill.
We don't comment on policies in terms of opposing them or advocating them, but I will make a couple observations about Waxman and Markey I think that are relevant. One observation is that when I was showing that chart about different technology portfolios and I was describing a CO2 emissions constraint of flat for 10 years, 2010 to 20, and then declining 3% a year, the Waxman Markey constraint is a lot tighter than that. So you would see a lot more pressure on a technology portfolio that has to respond to that constraint. So that's one observation. So it's a very challenging constraint. The second thing I would say is that obviously a really important part of that bill is the design on the offsets and to what extent offsets are available and can be purchased to offset emissions. The only thing I would just say there is that the degree to which those offsets are well-defined and can be verified and monitored will translate to a more stable CO2 price and will thus enable investments to be made in the utility sector because of an understanding of a stable price. The degree to which they do not achieve that will result in either uncertainty or volatility in that CO2 price, and that will tend to be a disincentive for investment. So I think the utility community's hope is that there is a well-defined basis for the price of CO2, and part of that equation is the design of the offsets.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Rodney White. I'm from Gas Daily. To Mr. Trice, could you go into a little more detail about the problems with the Waxman-Markey, and also do you have any points of view about the to get legislation and Mr. Hinchey's legislation regarding the EPA? How about that for a mouthful?
As I said, that's a 1,200-page bill. We're having an analysis done right now, but basically in Waxman-Markey, the credits that have been given out are a disincentive to switch to lower carbon fuels. That to us is inconsistent with a bill that's designed to reduce CO2 emissions. So that's our principal concern about the bill. But we haven't, we're in the process of doing a detailed analysis of that bill, and we'll have more to say about it later. As far as the bills that have been introduced to regulate hydraulic fracturing, I tried to comment on that in my remarks. Our view is regulations already exist. If you bring that under the Safe Water Drinking Act, where it's been exempted, I think, on three or four different occasions, and bring the regulation to the federal level, you're going to be – you'll have a redundancy of what's currently being done at the state level, where we protect the groundwater and the drinking water. So it's a question of where is regulation best. As been mentioned earlier today, that not all shale plays are the same. Not every area you operate in is the same. And we believe regulation is best done where it's currently being done in this, and that's at the state level as opposed to the federal level. And as I mentioned, the EPA, I don't know where they get the people and the engineers to do the permitting process. We drill in good years about 35,000 wells in the U.S. About 95% of those wells, I'm guessing, are fracture stimulated. So you're talking about a pretty big job that's already very regulated. And again, I would just point you to the DOE primer on shale plays, because it really does go through and articulate all the regulations that already exist in this area.
Do you have anything you want to add? Yes, please.
I'm Mitzi Wertheim with the Energy Conversation. I'm wondering about the skills that are needed for drilling all these wells. I mean, one of the interesting things is if new jobs are opening up, there's been a real question about capable manpower in this country for these new jobs. And how are you training new people that you're bringing in that don't always start with the capabilities to do it?
I guess that's for me. If you pay people well, you get pretty well-qualified people, and drilling engineers and tool pushers are well paid in our industry. And now we don't own drilling rigs as a company. We contract out drilling rigs, as most of our companies do. So we're looking to our contractors. We are constantly evaluating both their equipment, which is just as important, and we also evaluate their people and personnel. That's important to us because poor performance costs us money. So we're always looking to high grade our not only our equipment but the people we do business with, because it makes us more efficient drilling our wells, and we have better economics when we do that. I would tell you that the industry responded heroically. I think 5 years ago we were down to about drilling 700 or 800 rigs. We took that to 2,000 rigs as the shale plays started to expand. And with better prices, we're now back to about 950 rigs, because most of these plays, let me rephrase that, probably none of these plays work at $3.75. We need better gas prices to really respond as an industry. But, you know, because we can hedge effectively under current regulations and current practices, you know, we're able to continue to drill. But it's something we constantly monitor, because, again, it affects the bottom line.
Yes, please. Hi, Nick Snow from Oil and Gas Journal. This question is for Mr. Trice. You may have noticed that during the first panel, not only the panelist from the NRDC, but also a member of the audience from EPA raised the question of carbon and other environmental impacts during the drilling and recovery of the natural gas resource, and raised the life cycle question. Has ANGA and its members started to look into this extensively, and how is it prepared to respond?
ANGA has not looked at that issue. As I mentioned earlier, at Newfield, we're measuring our carbon footprint. Number one, we know that's going to be required. And we want to do it because our shareholders want to know that. So it's part of a sustainability report that we'll be doing. So once we measure it and can quantify that, you know, we can figure out roughly what those numbers are. I don't have that today. That's not something, you know, it's a year-long process to be doing this. We just kicked it off. We bought the software and have dedicated people to the effort. But it also tells you where you can attack it and where you can reduce your emissions in the field. And we didn't have enough time to go through this today, but I mentioned a process that we're using to, when we recover the water that goes in the fracks, we have a process with a company now that's developed that will actually clean that water up to where you can drink it, can go back in streams. Obviously, we can't do that today until we've been through all the steps with the EPA. But again, handling water is 30% of our cost. So it's in our interest to figure out how to clean up after ourselves, how to be able to recycle and reuse that water, not have to have trucks come in and haul that water away. Those are emissions when you drive a truck in. And so you can reduce carbon footprint just by using new technologies. And we're doing that every day. Again, it affects bottom line. But I don't have an answer for you today. I don't think that's something that ANGA will do. I do think that's something that every company will be doing.
Thank you. Kevin Massey from the Brookings Institution. This is a question that I suppose is most relevant to Mr. James. Earlier this year, the chairman of FERC said that he envisaged a future in which there may not be a need for any more nuclear power plants or coal-fired power stations. I'd be curious to hear your views on the feasibility of that future and the role that natural gas would play in such a future.
Okay, well, yes, we have had a lot of questions about Mr. Wellinghoff's remarks since that he made them. The first thing I'd like to do is reframe the question in one very basic way. Very often when questions are asked, like the way the questions as he was asked, they're framed in the terms of choosing between technologies. Should we have a nuclear, should we have efficiency, should we have renewables, or should we have natural gas, and so on. And I think any rational examination of the magnitude of energy consumption we have in the United States and of electricity consumption would tell you quickly that we are way past the point we have the luxury of choosing between things. It's a question of how much gas we want to have and how much we want to have renewables, efficiency, all these technologies. And then the criterion becomes, well, what is the criteria by which you should choose the proportion of those? We basically break that problem down into two pieces. One piece of it is a technical feasibility of any particular combination of technologies, and the other piece of that is economic feasibility. How much will it cost to produce electricity for a given combination of technologies? That's one approach, and use a set of criteria you can devise based around those questions. And the value of that aspect of the approach is it's quantitative. You can estimate costs, you can do calculations like the chart I showed you, and you can make estimates. The other side of that equation is more of a political and social question, which is value that is seen for certain technologies, which is believed not to be quantified but has value. Like perhaps there are aspects of environmental quality associated with renewables that are difficult to quantify but are believed to represent a value. So now the answer to your question. Our approach is to establish what is economically and technically optimum and provide that as a baseline on which you can then overlay these social and political concerns with respect to technologies. From the perspective of an economic and technical feasibility standpoint, an optimum portfolio is going to be a lot more balanced than a world in which you rely solely on, say, renewables and wind, renewables and, say, efficiency. Now, is it technically feasible? I would say yes. I would say if cost is no object, and if we were not concerned with consumption of land, water, and other resources in very different proportions than we have today, I think we could engineer a system with a transmission system to do that. But I think it would be very expensive. I think it would probably be less reliable in terms of energy production. And I think it would have some unintended consequences that would turn out to have would be socially unacceptable. So our point of view is to focus on optimizing the economic and technical and then inject that into the political process for the other decisions to be made.
Okay, I think we have time for one or maybe two more questions, depending upon how quick they are. Why don't we go back here?
Thank you. Leonard Oberlander. I would like to ask a general viewpoint about the focus of regulation within a state versus federal regulation, as you described it earlier. States, often neighboring states, compete with each other for tax revenues, and the transportation of natural gas is interstate. If there is state regulation primacy, it means, on the one hand, that the governors and the legislators of the state have as their constituent the corporation that is based within that state, while the neighboring state's governor and legislature don't. On the other hand, there is the issues of campaign contributions and financial power and that enters into the picture, the same as it does in the federal government. Could you, in a general way, reflect a little bit on how these differences may impact on the focus of regulation at the state level rather than at the federal level?
It'll have to be real general. My remarks, I mean, there's clearly things, there are some things that are better regulated at the federal level, and transportation is one that's regulated at the federal level. That's what the FERC does. And so, I mean, we have, you know, my remarks earlier were really around the drilling of the well, you know, and again, because one size regulation, which often happens at the federal level, doesn't work very well when you have different cultural situations, you have different geology, you have a lot of different things that revolve around the drilling of the well that we believe, in large part, and the federal government has generally agreed, are better done at the state level. And again, I would point you to the shale gas primer. But there are clearly things that have to be done at the federal level, and we jump through lots of hoops. We operate in the Gulf of Mexico. The Minerals Management Service is both our landlord and our regulator, and they're a good one, and they're a cooperative one. We work well together, and it's a very safe and sound, both from environmentally and human standpoint, operation in the Gulf of Mexico. So, again, I don't know that there's one answer that answers your question. It depends on, you know, the particular issue.
You've been very patient, so we'll just do one more quick one, and then we'll wrap it up.
Alulu from EIA.
the latest data shows that the working storage capacity wouldn't be in a position to accommodate the injection seasons. And there are some speculation that natural gas price may collapse or crash by September, October. I don't know whether you agree with this assessment. If you do, what will be the implication on the independents? Who will be able to stay and who will be able to really go?
I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing the question. Can you amplify it for me a
bit? If I understood, there are some projections that the natural gas price may collapse by September or October of this year. And so one question is, would you agree with that hypothesis? And secondly, if that were to be true, what would happen to the independent producers? Who would be able to stay and who would need to go?
It's a good thing I went to law school. I can answer that. It depends. and it depends on a lot of things. I mean, I mentioned earlier that last October we were drilling with 2,000 rigs in this country. We're now down to about 950 rigs. That will ultimately have an impact on the amount of daily production that we have in the U.S. We're just beginning to see the implications of that. It takes a while to go through the system. So most analysts are projecting that production will fall, and you remember the market's always thinking ahead, so you know the market's going to worry about what that price is going to be next year. There are a lot of wild cards. Weather is a huge wild card that most people really don't understand well in the natural gas business. When it's not cold in the winter, that's not good, and when it's not hot in the summer, that's not good for consumption. So if you have a very mild summer, which we started out having, you're going to build more inventory of natural gas and storage. If you fill storage up and consumption is down, you have to shut in production, and that means somebody doesn't get revenue unless they're hedged. And that would have implications on probably some of the smaller producers. Another wild card is LNG, and that was mentioned today. LNG will not come to the U.S. right now economically because the prices are higher internationally. But if you get a glut of LNG and it doesn't have anywhere to go, the U.S. does have storage capacity, albeit it's filling up pretty quick. So I don't think LNG will – frankly, I don't think LNG will be a factor. If I knew where the price of natural gas was going, I'd be trading, and I don't do that. I don't speculate. I only sell my gas forward that I own. But they're just – I would tell you it's a bearish – the sentiment's very bearish in the market right now, and I think that's appropriate. I would tell you that we hedged 75% of our gas for 2010 because we don't think this situation cures itself quickly, but it will. I mean, it will be self-correcting, and we'll get gas prices back to some kind of equilibrium, which makes these shale plays attractive economically.
Okay, I think we're about out of time. Frank, I don't know if you wanted to say a few words to close us out, but in the meantime, I hope you'll join me in thanking Revis and David for our panel. Thank you. Sarah's going to close us out. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Okay, thank you. And everybody, we really appreciate you being here today. We thought it was a really interesting discussion for those of us who have been following these issues and trying to make sense out of them for a few months. It's been really helpful for us. I always forget to say slides will be posted on our website a couple days, maybe tomorrow, following today's event. I think we definitely heard a message of abundance in terms of the resource base. But we also heard that sort of the factors that determine whether or not you actually produce those resources aren't really straightforward, and the factors that decide how much of that resource that you consume aren't really straightforward, which sort of leads us to this decade of uncertainty that Revis talked about with both sides of the production and consumption cycle, both the people who produce the resource and the people who use the resource, not really having the certainty, the lack of volatility that they need and want to determine their business choices and our outlook going forward. So that kind of all leads back to Frank's triangle, which most roads do, I'm finding, where sort of diversity and a full portfolio while managing these resources in the near term is really important. So we will, rest assured, be following these issues as well, probably both of our institutions. And so we want to thank you guys for coming. And I'd be remiss in not thanking the entire CSIS and WRI team for everything they did to put the session together today. And thank all of you for coming. So thanks.